The murder of Helen Clevenger is one of Asheville, North Carolina's most infamous murder cases. In July of 1936, the 18-year-old college student was murdered in a room at the Battery Park Hotel. A hotel employee was tried, convicted, and executed for Helen's murder, but his conviction remains highly contested. In fact, some people say his conviction was a case of injustice. This is the mystery of the murder at the Battery Park Hotel. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Joseph Clevenger and his daughter, Helen, had a special connection. In July of 1936, Helen had been away from the family's Staten Island, New York home, touring North Carolina with her uncle, Professor William Clevenger. On July 15th of 1936, Joseph Clevenger retired to his room, never imagining the horror that awaited him. In the early morning hours of July 16th, Joseph was awakened by a disturbing dream. The recurring dream was hazy. All he could remember was his daughter begging for help and saying something about knowing her daddy would understand. As the sun rose, Joseph Clevenger went to his office at the Food and Drug Administration. He was unable to focus because he just kept feeling something wasn't quite right. He felt a sense of dread. Around noon, he received a telegram from Asheville, North Carolina authorities. They inquired as to whether he was the father of Helen Clevenger. He tried to contact authorities, but was unable to do so. He returned to his home, where he would be met by authorities from his local police department. They delivered the news no parent should hear about their child. His daughter, Helen, was gone, had been brutally murdered in her room at Battery Park Hotel in the early morning hours of July 16th. Helen Clevenger was 18 years old in the summer of 1936. She had grown up in a loving home with her family on Staten Island. She felt loved and excited about her future as she finished her freshman year at NYU. The young woman was known as brainy and beautiful to her friends and family. The blonde-haired beauty took a break from all the hard work and studying of that first year of college to join her Uncle William on a tour of the South. Helen left New York in June of 1936 and met her Uncle William Clevenger at his home in Raleigh, North Carolina. William Clevenger was a respected professor at North Carolina State College, where he taught agriculture and food science. The professor had no children of his own and valued his role as Helen's uncle. The two were very close. Professor Clevenger planned a week-long road trip with stops at a few colleges. According to the New York Daily News, the stops at those colleges were meant to inspire Helen to pursue science and medicine as career options. We know that Helen loved the trip and was excited by each stop because she loved to keep a detailed diary. She wrote of each stop along the way and shared that she felt so free and grown up as she toured the South and met fascinating people. Helen's diary entry for July 11th, 1936, tells us this was the first day she and her uncle arrived in Asheville, North Carolina, in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Western North Carolina. A visit to Asheville meant tourists would see unique architecture. It was a city that welcomed unique people and styles, very cosmopolitan, which was why folks called Asheville the Paris of the South. Tourists were enthralled by this beautiful city and the mountain air, a cool reprieve from the summer heats of surrounding states. William Clevenger and his niece Helen checked into one of the finest hotels in the South, the Battery Park Hotel, on July 11th, 1936. They stayed on the third floor and then left for another leg of their road trip. When they returned to Asheville on July 14th, They checked in and were assigned rooms on the second floor. It was here, in room 224, where Helen would write her final diary entry before she met her tragic end in Asheville. These days, Asheville's Battery Park Hotel serves as the Battery Park apartment homes for seniors. The residents here know the history of the hotel, the former glory of the building, and the dark history attached to what was the second Battery Park Hotel in Asheville. The first Battery Park was built on a 10-acre hill, which was a former Civil War battery. Built in 1886, the first Battery Park Hotel was known as one of the most modern resorts in the late 19th century, complete with a fireplace in each room, electric lights throughout, and it was the first hotel in the South to install an electric elevator. But by 1921, the building had lost some of its appeal. Years of mismanagement led to the owner selling the property to Edwin Grove, who had developed Asheville's Grove Park Inn, the Grove Park neighborhood, and Grove Arcade. Grove wanted a clean slate for his dream for this hotel. He had the original Battery Park Hotel on the hill demolished and opted to build the new Battery Park Hotel on the original site, opening for business in 1924. That move to demolish the original Battery Park and replace it with a grand 14-story neoclassical structure left many of Asheville's residents frustrated, to say the least. Asheville native and author Thomas Wolfe described the new Battery Park Hotel in his book, You Can't Go Home Again, writing the following: "It was being stamped out of the same mold as if by some gigantic biscuit cutter of hotels had produced 1,000 others like it all over the country." Tourists did not share this sentiment. They loved the Grand Hotel. Many famous people were guests, including Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Grace Kelly, and Boris Karloff, F. Scott Fitzgerald, O. Henry, and yes, in time, even Thomas Wolfe stayed at the Battery Park. Professor William Clavinger and his niece fit right in with the affluent clientele who checked in to Battery Park in its heyday. The day after the professor and his niece checked in, they would leave to meet friends. At about 10:30 on the evening of July 15th, the two returned to the hotel, said goodnight, and retired to their rooms. Helen to room 224, and her uncle to his room just down the hall. We know Helen changed into her night clothes, wrote a letter to a friend to share her adventures on her road trip, and took time to share the events of the day in her diary. A fierce storm moved through Asheville that night, an electrical storm that lit the sky with lightning and left many people scared by the sound of thunder. Thunder so loud that around midnight, a guest on the second floor of the Battery Park Hotel would later say he was awakened to what he thought was the sound of a gunshot. The guest contacted the front desk to ask if he should be concerned, and they immediately called their house detective, Daniel Gaddy, to investigate. Gaddy walked up and down the halls and would later say he stopped at a couple of the guest rooms on the second floor to listen and see if anything seemed wrong. But all was quiet, and Gaddy returned to his room, assuming the guest had only heard thunder and nothing ominous. Hours later, around 8 a.m. on July 16th, William Clevenger stood outside of room 224 to knock on the door and wake up his niece. He knocked several times and didn't get an answer. He turned the doorknob to find it was unlocked. As he entered Helen's room, William Clevenger saw his niece on the floor, her night clothes covered in blood, her once beautiful face almost unrecognizable. According to Marla Milling's Wicked Asheville, Helen's body was slumped in the floor near the door to her room. She was on her back with her legs doubled beneath her. Her left hand was on her chest and her right arm was curled above her head. Blood from a gunshot wound to the chest stained her green striped silk night clothes. Her face was badly bruised and mutilated from being bludgeoned and slashed. An autopsy would reveal that Helen Clevenger's cause of death was hemorrhagic shock from a .32 caliber gunshot wound to the chest, which penetrated her lung. Investigators would find a .32 caliber bullet casing on the floor of Helen's room and later identified the bullet as coming from a .32 caliber German automatic. As to the mutilation of Helen's face, they assumed that had been caused by pistol whipping with a gun that had a sharp edge or a sharp weapon of some kind. Authorities worked to find a motive for Helen's murder, but they had few leads. There were no signs of sexual assault, which was confirmed by the coroner. Robbery was considered, but Helen's watch was still in the room, along with the cash in her purse. Helen wrote of every event in her life in her diary. Police pored over that diary, but found no mention of a love interest or someone who had made Helen feel ill at ease or threatened in any way. Authorities found themselves at a loss as to why someone would kill such an innocent young woman. The public expressed outrage over the murder of Helen Clevenger. Hotel operators were worried that tourism would be affected by the murder. And the public in general, well, they were just afraid and demanded that Sheriff Lawrence Brown make an arrest quickly. Sheriff Brown detained Helen's uncle, William, because he had discovered the body. Authorities also detained Daniel Gaddy, the house detective, who had been called to the second floor just hours earlier, only to return to his room claiming it was thunder, not a gunshot a hotel guest had reported during the night. Police went so far as to send hair found in Helen's room to the FBI lab for a detailed comparison with a hair sample from Daniel Gaddy. There was no match, and Gaddy would, in time, be set free. Brown held him in jail in the hopes that he would suddenly remember something important from the night of the murder that could lead to a break in the case. When authorities questioned Helen's uncle, William, they learned that there was a mystery related to the key to Helen's room. William Clevenger told police that when he didn't get an answer, when he knocked on Helen's door that morning, he turned the doorknob and found that it was unlocked. But as Marla Milling shared in her book, Wicked Asheville, investigators found a hotel pass key still in the lock on the outside of the door, while the regular key to the room was found covered in blood under the radiator inside the room. Authorities weren't able to find a clear fingerprint on either of those keys. Now, according to Wicked Asheville, a report in the July 23rd issue of the Asheville Citizen revealed the key found in the lock was a mysterious 12th key. There were supposed to be 11 of these keys out, all of them master pass keys that would open a guest room, even though it was locked from the inside and the guest's key in the lock. The 11 keys were in the possession of the persons to whom they had been issued. Sheriff Brown claimed the 12th key was used by the murderer to open the door to Helen Clevenger's room. How the murderer got his hands on the key remains a mystery. The evidence in room 224 left police with no leads as to the identity of the person who had murdered Helen Clevenger. Fingerprints found on objects around the room were labeled as useless by authorities. During the course of police interviews with hotel guests and employees, authorities learned that 10 people heard screams coming from what they thought was room 224 in the middle of the night. Only one of them called the front desk to report a concern, either due to the belief that the sounds were from the fierce storm the night before, or because they assumed someone else would report it. No one could confirm they heard a gunshot in the night, because the storm made them doubt what they had heard. At least three people did tell police they had seen suspicious people in the hotel the night Helen was murdered. One of the most suspicious seen by one of the hotel hall boys, who came forward to tell authorities he had seen a mysterious man in the hotel that night. The hall boy said he was taking a break in part of the lobby that wasn't well lit when he saw a strange man pass by and sneak into the hotel manager's office. Joshua Warren recounted the details of this witness statement in his book, Haunted Asheville, writing that the hall boy did go into the manager's office, which was not lit at this time of night. He looked around to see if he saw the mysterious man, but saw no one. He walked back into the lobby, began to chat with another hall boy, when he heard the screen door slam between the hotel manager's office and the hotel porch. The hall boy ran to the main hotel door and saw the mystery man jump from the high porch railing to the street, where he ran down the corner at O'Henry Street and continued toward Haywood Street and then disappeared. The hall boy gave the best description he could, noting that the man was white, looked to be about 5'8" or 9 inches tall, and weighed about 160 to 180 pounds. Sheriff Brown and his team spoke with several witnesses regarding this event, which led them to one statement from a witness that they felt was questionable. They had spoken with a man who had heard a friend mention he had a date with a young woman at the Battery Park Hotel on the night of the murder, a date with a woman he had met at the hotel 2 days earlier. Considering Helen and her Uncle William had checked into the hotel, left, then returned 2 days later for a second stay, the sheriff couldn't help but wonder if the date the man was referring to was with Helen Clevenger, or could at the very least be associated with Helen Clevenger. The sheriff wanted to know more about this man and his date. On July 18th, Sheriff Brown ordered the man detained for questioning. His name? Mark Wallner. Wallner was an internationally known violinist who had lived in Nashville for close to 2 years. He was estranged from his wife and child, who were living in Washington, D.C. Wallner's studio was just across the street from the Battery Park Hotel. Just after he was taken into custody, the county physician examined Mark Wallner, and according to Wicked Asheville, he had a fresh cut across the toes of his left foot, a bruised left heel, and strange stains on his trousers. Police couldn't help but wonder if Wallner's injuries to his left foot had been the result of a jump from the high railing at the hotel and the hard landing on the street below. Was Mark Wallner the mysterious man the hotel hall boy had seen the night Helen Clevenger was murdered? When questioned by the sheriff, Wallner explained that he was in no way involved with what happened at the Battery Park Hotel on the evening of July 15th because he had been home by 9:30 p.m. on the 15th and didn't leave his home until 8:30 on the morning of July 16th. And he had someone who could back up his story. His alibi was confirmed by Mildred Ward, who was a 19-year-old daughter of Wallner's landlady, who claimed the two were involved. Mildred Ward told police Wallner was at home, but after a few hours of questioning, she told police Wallner had called her just before he was detained by police, asking her where he had been the night Helen Clevenger was killed, so the two could be on the same page. Sheriff Brown questioned other witnesses who seemed to punch holes in Wallner's alibi. In all, 8 witnesses contradicted Mark Wallner's account of his whereabouts between the evening of July 15th and the morning of July 16th. A cafe owner said Wallner was seen eating around 10 p.m. on the night of the murder. An Asheville reporter, Doug Eller, told police he spotted Wallner drinking beer around 10:30 that night. At 2 a.m., a female witness said she saw Wallner walking down the street not far from Battery Park Hotel. And at about 6 a.m., 19-year-old Charles English said he served Wallner coffee in the cafe where he worked. An article from the Lawrence Journal World on July 20th, 1936, recounts the final hole in Mark Wallner's alibi coming from one of his neighbors, Miss Leveda Whitaker, who said she had seen Wallner arrive home around 6:30 on the morning of July 16th. He walked up to the home with a limp, as if he had been injured, knocked on Miss Ward's window, and then entered the home through the back entrance. A few hours later, Miss Whitaker saw Wallner and Miss Ward on the back porch of the home, and Wallner left, carrying a pair of trousers under his arm. The clothes Mark Wallner wore the day he was detained and 2 days before were sent to the state chemist for testing, including Wallner's sport coat, trousers, shirt, tie, and other apparel. Due to the lack of concrete evidence to file any charges against him, Sheriff Brown released Mark Wallner on July 24th. On August 4th of 1936, the Cumberland Evening Times revealed that the sheriff either neglected to pursue any evidence against Wallner or let potentially important evidence fall back into the hands of a suspect. It was revealed that Sheriff Brown never made an official request that analysis be carried out on Woolner's clothing or stains on them. Therefore, the state chemist never ran tests. He waited word from Asheville and never got directions or a response. Mark Woolner pressed the sheriff's office to return his clothing, and that request was acknowledged and honored. Woolner was now a free man, and police began to focus on another suspect. They were now convinced that the murder of Helen Clevenger was an inside job, that a Battery Park Hotel employee had killed Helen. Sheriff Brown was under increasing pressure to make an arrest, and Helen Clevenger's father, back in New York, was growing increasingly concerned that the investigation wasn't as thorough as it should be. Helen Clevenger's father called in favors, and as the New York Daily News reported, the NYPD dispatched two ace detectives to Asheville, John Quinn Jr. and Thomas Martin, who his boss called the best homicide man in the world. Within hours of the ace detectives arriving in Asheville, Sheriff Brown claimed he had a promising new suspect. A hotel employee had told the sheriff to question Martin Moore. Moore worked as a hall boy at the Battery Park. The 22-year-old African-American was developmentally challenged. Moore was not known as a violent man. In fact, he was easygoing and a hard worker and had no criminal record, which is why the events that unfolded after the murder of Helen Clevenger left his family, friends, and his coworkers in shock. Police went to Moore's home to question him on August 9th, the day they learned he had acquired a gun not long before the murder. Moore denied he had a gun, but as police continued to question him, he told police he would show them where it was. He led them to a crawl space under his home where a .32-caliber Spanish automatic was found wrapped in burlap. Police had determined the .32-caliber that killed Helen Clevenger had come from a German automatic. Moore told police he had lent his gun to another employee at the hotel 2 days before Helen Clevenger was murdered, and the employee returned the gun the day after the murder. Police found the gun was similar to the gun that killed Helen, but not an exact match. Still, they arrested Martin Moore. After hours of intense interrogation of Moore, Sheriff Brown made a shocking announcement. Not only did he have Helen Clevenger's murderer in custody, the killer had confessed. To prove it, the sheriff released documents detailing Martin Moore's confession. Moore told police he had planned to enter a room on the second floor to see if there was anything valuable inside. He found two other doors were locked, but when he got to room 224, it was unlocked. So he walked in, not expecting to find a guest inside. When Helen Clevenger saw Moore and screamed, he claimed he killed her because he was scared too, and things got out of control. The gun just went off. Moore's claim that he had tried other doors before finding Helen's unlocked seemed off and brought his confession into question by local media. The author of Wicked Asheville noted this, pointing out that Sheriff Brown said the key piece of evidence in the case of who killed Helen Clevenger came down to the 12th key, the master key that was found on the outside lock of her door on the morning she was discovered dead in room 224. The sheriff said whoever had used that key must be the killer, but if Moore had passed by doors that had been locked before he went to room 224 and found the door unlocked, that would mean he wasn't holding the mysterious 12th key, the master key, and didn't use it to enter any room, including Helen's room. The sheriff would explain this away, saying the master key in the door the morning Helen's body was found must have been placed there after the murder by someone who was afraid to acknowledge that they had it and didn't want to be questioned. Martin Moore would later claim that his confession was made in the hopes that police would stop beating him. During the course of his interrogation, Martin Moore claimed he was coerced into confessing by Sheriff Brown and was beaten with a rubber hose by a fat man from New York, which, according to the New York Daily News, was apparently a reference to John Quinn Jr., one of those detectives that had been sent to Asheville to assist with the investigation. Martin Moore insisted he was innocent and had been forced into a confession, despite having an alibi at the time of Helen Clevenger's murder. Several witnesses maintain Martin Moore was at a birthday party with family and friends the night Helen Clevenger was murdered. At that party with family until the early morning hours of July 16th. And if robbery had been a motive, the reason Martin Moore confessed to entering room 224 on the night Helen died, why had robbery been ruled out early on in the investigation due to nothing being taken from the room? Remember, Helen's watch and the cash in her purse were in plain sight and remained in the room on the morning she was found dead. Martin Moore didn't fit the eyewitness description of the man seen rushing away from the hotel around the time Helen was believed to have been murdered. The man who had been seen running through the hotel manager's office and then leaping from the building to the streets below had been described as a white man, about 5'8" or 5'9". Martin Moore was, of course, African American and had been described by reporters covering the trial as a lanky giant of a man. Despite those contradictions and a lack of evidence placing Martin Moore in Helen Clevenger's room the night she was murdered, Martin Moore was indicted and charged with 2 counts of capital murder. Moore's trial began August 19th of 1936 with his attorney, J. Scroop Stiles, pleading to save his life. Stiles knew it would be a hard battle to win. He knew a black man standing trial for the murder of a white woman in North Carolina in the 1930s stood little chance of a fair trial. Stiles argued that Moore's initial confession should not be part of the official court record, nor should it be presented to the jury because Moore had recanted his confession. Stiles argued that the confession was beaten out of a vulnerable and low-educated man who felt helpless and wanted the beatings to stop when he was being interrogated. Judge Don Phillips approved the confession and allowed it to be presented as evidence, which sealed Martin Moore's fate. The all-white jury deliberated for less than an hour before they returned a unanimous guilty verdict. Martin Moore was sentenced to death in North Carolina's gas chamber, which had replaced electrocution as a means of death sentence in 1935. When the sentence was handed down, Martin Moore was stoic and showed no emotion. There was an outcry from the general public in Asheville, with a large number of white and African American residents joining together to decry the verdict as unfair, claiming Sheriff Brown had arrested the wrong man and left the city in danger. There were calls for the NAACP to step in and help with the appeal, help save Martin Moore's life. Representatives from the organization had been in court for each of the 4 days of the trial, monitoring the proceedings. They had initially felt Moore was getting a fair trial, but as the testimony continued, the NAACP felt they needed to organize a campaign to save Martin Moore's life. As the New York Daily News noted, the campaign would be too little, too late for Martin Moore. The judge ordered justice be swift. Martin Moore was initially scheduled to die in the gas chamber on October 2nd, 1936. But he received an automatic stay when the state Supreme Court granted him a review of his case. In early November, Moore's attorney attempted to file his appeal, but was told he had missed a court-mandated deadline, and the appeal would not be heard. Martin Moore maintained his innocence until his last breath, which came on December 11th, 1936. Before his cell was unlocked and guards would lead him to the gas chamber, 2 ministers joined Moore in singing "Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior." Martin Moore was weeping as he was led into the gas chamber in Raleigh at 10:30 a.m. He was seated, the room was sealed, and at 10:33 a.m., gas was released into the chamber. 12 minutes later, Martin Moore was declared dead. To this day, there's unease around the story of Helen Clevenger's murder. A beautiful young woman whose life held so much promise met a tragic end while on a trip she believed was leading her to answers about her future. Her family was left to mourn her loss and question what many questioned, whether her killer was the man executed for the crime. Many still believe Helen Clevenger's killer got away with murder, and a confused and innocent man died in the North Carolina gas chamber on December 11th, 1936. Perhaps that's why Helen Clevenger's spirit is said to haunt the Battery Park Hotel that now serves as the Battery Park Apartments. Some past and present residents have claimed to hear and see strange things inside that building, things that have made them feel uncomfortable, or at the very least, like they were not alone. And occasionally there have been loud sounds, as though something, or perhaps someone, is falling to the ground below. The falling sounds, well, those claims are related to other deaths at the Battery Park Hotel. Access to the Battery Park is restricted these days, but in the past, people have made their way to the top of the building to meet their end. Two such cases involve similar stories of suicide, one in the 1930s and one in the 1970s. Joshua Warren recounts the stories in Haunted Asheville. On September 2, 1943, around 7:30 a.m., a U.S. government official named Clinton Allhite made his way to the roof of the Battery Park Hotel. The 46-year-old pulled a chair to the guardrail of the roof to aid him in his mission and jumped. Decades later, in 1972, a patient at a local mental institution, 28-year-old Michael Burns, was permitted to leave the hospital to attend Mass. He took a taxi to the Battery Park Hotel and gained access to the roof by way of the freight elevator. Just like Allhite, Burns pulled a chair to the guardrail on the roof and jumped. As Warren noted, neither Allhite nor Burns left a note, and there were no witnesses to their deaths. The Battery Park Hotel was a symbol of wealth and glory for Asheville, but by late 1972, the hotel had closed, and over time, ownership changed, leading to its current status as apartment homes. The infamous murder room, 224, was converted as part of the change to apartments. But converting a room can't change the history of the building or what occurred here decades ago. In 2016, Carol Hubbard, a resident of the Battery Park Apartments, told Asheville's Mountain Express she'd heard strange noises around the building, saying, "I think Helen Clevenger's ghost is here, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if the man who was wrongly executed for her death is hanging around here too." Residents and visitors have shared countless stories of apparitions of Helen in the hallways. The most unsettling of accounts is that Helen Clevenger has been seen, bloody and disoriented, seemingly staggering through the halls on stormy nights. Her spirit lingering here, unable to break away from the last place she laughed and dreamed of her future, as she wrote her final diary entry from the Battery Park Hotel in the Paris of the South. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. If you're ever in Asheville, North Carolina, you can see the Battery Park Hotel at 1 Battle Square at the corner of O. Henry Street. The building's first floor is full of businesses, but the upper-level apartments are closed to the public. You can see photos of the hotel and photos of Helen Clevenger and read more about this case in the full show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. If you enjoy the show, make sure you subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen so folks know you found a show you like that they may like too. Thanks for listening.